tēnā koutou katoa and shalom. Funnily enough, that joke came round on my email yesterday, and it was slightly different. he's censored it. One of the people in between was a prostitute who was at the hotel first. He was being shy. It was quite amusing. Thank you for inviting me here. The planners of the session, I assume David had asked me, but I had thought of me, but I gathered actually tonight that it was suggested to him. And whoever did must have been deciding to have quite a bit of fun by putting the Attorney General and me on the same panel. And, rather different views. And I didn't know at the time that he was another speaker, but I'm thrilled to bits about being on the same panel with completely different views. I was also very glad to hear from the Imam mention of, I think at his first level, the protection of women and children as one of the principles of Islam. Because until that moment, I don't think you would have known from the first two speakers that there were two genders around. If you listen to the list of the heritage people in both the early part of his speech, although I don't know genders, but I suspect they are entirely in Islam names, but I suspect so. And certainly in the whole of Chris's speech, there was not one single mention of any woman authority I specifically noticed.
You,
Sorry?
I missed that.
Quite so. And also, I think a great deal of the economics that underlies Chris's vision is very much the public world and the world of paid labour. You don't get much glimpse there of the unpaid work, the household caring, bringing up the next generation, voluntary work that underpins the whole of the paid work. And as a feminist economist, I take a great deal of attention to that. I too will talk about the positions I come from, although some of them will be obvious already. In doing so, I'll also remember that religion, sex and money are the things that we often don't talk about very much in public, that we're a bit shy about talking about those three. I'll leave out sex for today. But religion and money we are very much talking about. It's interesting that in the population census, income is the worst answered question. People are very shy about revealing their incomes. They may be a bit scared that it goes to the tax man, which it doesn't from Statistics New Zealand, but it's a poorly answered question. And religion is the one and only one with an actual option refused to answer because of its sensitivity. At the 2006 New Zealand census, about half the New Zealand population said they had no religion or ticked the refused to answer box or simply left it out, almost just about half, which is quite a thing for thought for religious communities. Of course, economics is about much more than money. It concerns the whole allocation of scarce resources, making choices under constraints and under scarcity, the what, how, for whom questions that we all learn about when we do stage one economics. I'm not going to talk about the minutiae of economic policy, but what I see as the big issues, which are, and take a very different perspective on them from Chris's. Since I don't believe that there is such a thing as scientific objectivity or value freedom in the social sciences, there are increasing doubts there even is in the physical sciences, that's why part of the reasons why I declare where I come from, value-wise. For those who haven't run into me before, I describe myself on the topics for tonight, at any rate, as a lefty and a greenie, a feminist economist, and a Jewish agnostic. On the economic big issues, I'm totally against the orthodoxy of the last 25 years or so, with which Chris is in favour. I think it may be slowly changing from being the total orthodoxy for everyone. There are at least some doubts among it, not only from the traditional opponents, but from some of those who see what it's been up to lately. The major crises, financial and environmental, are certainly making some people worry a little bit, but not only about the debt stuff that you were referring to, but about the whole basis of what we're doing. But it's very slow to have much impact, this, on major decision makers. There is certainly, and I'm not a Luddite, although you'll see in a moment that have a lot of questions about growth. Nevertheless, I'm anything but a Luddite in that I think technological change that is for the good of people in health and technology and communication is terrific. And as far as I'm concerned, email and the web are one of the greatest things we've ever had. They're terrific communications where we can really find out what's going on in other parts of the world, and social justice movements, for example, can communicate with each other when the media are, like so many other things, the main media, owned by the big corporations and those who benefit from current orthodoxy. So I think it's terrific being able to have all groups in touch with each other. Of course, you have to have a great deal of scepticism about what appears on the web, like everything else. It isn't all true. There is no truth and objectivity, but you do have far quicker and easier access to all sorts of events and opinions and reactions to them. Just saying a bit more about the orthodoxy I am opposed to. I mean, essentially, that we had during the 1950s to the late 1970s, we had quite rapid economic growth, although my doubts about growth will emerge. But we also had benign welfare states in the developed world. But, of course, we only had certain people even benefiting from the range of that. There were still huge international inequality issues and race, class and gender issues within countries, but we had a reasonable growth decades. And as that growth period, for a lot of different reasons, started to come to an end or stutter, this was replaced by a reversion to a more strictly market orthodoxy and what was often called the Washington Consensus. And it went with things like TINA, there is no alternative, and with it the notion of minimal state intervention, minimal regulation, simply to make the market work properly, and a minimal public sector just to improve the working of the market. Of course, they weren't necessarily that we had a minimal market and minimal public sector in practice, but certainly in theory, this was the direction of movement. Individualism works best. The individual choice leading to their own benefit and working for the benefit of all. Reward, risk, and innovation, as Chris says, the growth imperative, increased productivity will benefit everybody, and often there was talk of trickle down to all from that. In practice, of course, we did not have all individuals having an equal chance, even in that marketplace. We have an awful lot depends on where you are born and into what group. And then there is domination by the major corporations and by the major international agencies, WTO, World Bank, IMF, pushing structural adjustment policies and privatization onto the third world, modifying the free market only minimally to recognize interdependence and support the young, old, and those unable to be in paid work. That was the direction of movement, even if it wasn't all carried through. And all this, as I've mentioned, largely ignored the value of unpaid household and caring work. It was also when we're told about the need to grow, to get up to the top six, whatever it is, proportion of the OECD average, to get equal with Australia, and all those tired slogans, what we're being talked about is GDP, levels and growth of GDP. Gross domestic product, a measure of national income, often said to be a measure of economic activity, even as a measure of economic activity, it's only a measure of that which, again, takes place in the marketplace, again, ignoring household volunteering and caring work. The inadequacies of GDP have been known for many, many years, and one of the people who made them most publicised is another feminist economist called Marilyn Waring, who was also actually a National MP, but rather an oddly sat in the National Party for her views, although, of course, Muldoon was an interventionist to a far greater extent than the subsequent Labour governments, let alone the current National ones. So things change in political parties a great deal. Marilyn Waring wrote a book called Counting for Nothing about the undervaluation of women's work, and also talked of the inadequacies of GDP, both because of what it omits and what it includes. Growth increases if you'd have a huge amount of pollution and a huge need to clean it up. If you increase the number of wars and the armaments you need for war, all that is growth. And there are large parts of current GDP that are bads rather than goods, and there are an awful lot that is omitted from GDP, which is of far more value to human beings than some of the things that are included. So the fact that those figures are just used again and again, even though the inadequacies are known, and indeed, although Marilyn's work often isn't attributed these days, we've now got a heck of a lot of usually men from overseas coming over and telling us about GPI, genuine progress indicator. And the Sarkozy in France is almost a convert to this now, and there is at least the good signs, these are good signs, that broader indicators of economic activity are starting to be realised to be of more importance than simple GDP. In Bhutan, they talk about gross national happiness, which is a rather nice idea. Not easy to measure, but much broader than just simply pure economic activity. And all the orthodoxy that I was talking about has been reliant on GDP as its base, has led to vastly increased inequalities, absurd rewards in the places like the finance industry, not only the appalling derivatives and secondary mortgage market messes, but absurd, if we're talking about the market being, you know, what we should be using all the time, there is no way, it seems to me, that genuinely there is any rationality to the sort of reward structures that underlie what is supposedly market supply and demand in the wages front. Of course, in practice, in these big companies, essentially chief executives and directors can virtually set their own pay. There is no pure supply and demand in the market in that and in many other areas. And the reckless lending, greed and gambling that led to the credit bubble is, it just beggars belief, really. And it was well forecast by many people. Many people now, you can go back to find not the conventional economists, but many people who had forecast what was going to happen. But they are not in the areas of taking decisions. It is who takes the major economic decisions, who has the power to take those major decisions on scarcity and choice. We do not have equal choice and equal constraints, and the major decision makers are rather than each one individually has a great deal of power. Those ones who have the main power need to be called to account. So there are critiques of orthodoxy from many sides, and having insufficient impact, in my view. At the moment, the attempts to clean up the financial mess is really just a matter of attempting to shore up the previous system with bailouts. And in the meantime, we have a large number of economies. I mean, obviously, we've got Iceland, Greece, Spain, Europe is in something of a mess, and we just don't know how that is going to go. But even if bailouts stop the current crisis, we are not out of it in any real sense. And the ecological global warming crisis and the real problems facing the whole Earth are probably even more important and are still receiving insufficient attention. Little arguments about our emissions trading scheme are absolutely minor in the scale of the whole issue around the globe. So there are many critics who want to retreat from growth. 30,000 of them met in Bolivia last week, 2 weeks ago. I'm not sure that got any publicity in our newspapers. You had to find it on the web. There's a huge social movement who are critiquing all this. Many want to retreat from growth and conspicuous consumption towards sustainability and equality, less and fairer trade, not free trade, that Chris advocates, but fair trade, where the producers are paid exploitative amounts for ridiculously bad conditions, but fair trade, and we have a great fair trade movement. And we need less trade as well, only where it's really needed because of resource differences, not using up energy on transporting similar things from A to B and B to A because of branding. We need to use the technological change and brilliant human innovation to save the world and its people, animals and plants, not for ever more growth. Increasing inequality both within countries and high levels of inequality, there is increasing evidence that that alone is a source of huge social ills, that if you have greater equality, even without the levels of overall going up much, you have far less social unrest with all its bad costs. So things like Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, zero growth economy, much less ambition on the growth side is, I think, a really important set of movements that are going on. It's hard to get political traction for it, but in parts of Latin America, these ideas are starting to hold sway. And there's also retreat from the overall top world economy to building alternatives and living them at local level. I think that's also a very worthwhile trend. All the eco initiatives, transition towns, local trading schemes, local currencies and so on. And, of course, all the looking after each other locally in communities and internationally. So where do religious traditions in general and Jewish ones in particular fit into all this? How do they or should they inform economic policy? I don't pretend at all to be a Jewish scholar, and so I'm. This is on a fairly low level from my point of view on that side. But of course, certainly it's a major concern in Judaism and in most or all religions on interdependence, on looking after each other. The simple things like don't do unto others as you wouldn't have them do unto you, or better do unto others as you would have them do to you, love your neighbour as yourself. I think that these simple mantras are, or at least should be, the basic ethics of all religions and indeed, of course, of humanism. And those who do not believe in a religion, the ethics should not be that different, and probably isn't. But not that all religions or those who are not religious have adhered to them enough. And operationalising them is something else, and immediately becomes political. What is morality, fairness, equity, social justice? Well, as will have been obvious for me personally, social justice and social action does require a left-wing and green economic agenda. I completely accept that it doesn't for everyone, it doesn't for Chris. and of course, there are many observant and caring religious people who are right-wing individualists and genuinely believe that this helps everyone, including the poor. I was yesterday, funnily enough, in a Catholic cathedral, which is a very rare thing for me to be, at Bernie Galvin's funeral. He was Secretary of the Treasury with both Muldoon and Longy as Prime Ministers, and he's a Catholic and a free marketer himself, and I was very moved by the tributes paid to him and his social justice, social action agendas. He certainly combined them both very well, and I completely accept that it's possible. But I think it's misguided, of course. There's some evidence that Jewish people in the States at least tend to be on the liberal or more left wing of politics. They certainly tend to vote Democrat over Republican much more than the general population at large. I don't know of any evidence on New Zealand Jewish political opinion. I doubt that anybody's done a survey. It would be an interesting one. But I think a lot of religious groups which work at the coalface of poverty, such as take the downtown community ministry here in Wellington, for example, if they experience the realities day to day in their practical work for the disadvantaged, they tend to what can be seen as these more left-wing agendas that I've talked of in their advocacy work. A quote, DCM aligns itself with the poor and disadvantaged and is committed to addressing the root causes of poverty and injustice. DCM, of course, has been Christian-based and has 6 member churches, but our progressive synagogue, Temple Sinai, has recently just become part of their umbrella group. So it's no longer exclusively Christian. That's a very welcome development. But, of course, some religious groups, Christian and otherwise, especially fundamentalist ones, can be more right-wing. I very humbly not only stand in front of Temple Sinai and the Bema, as David said, and as cousin or cantor, but I also recently have done quite a few, you probably haven't been there for those, quite a few drasha or addresses, because we don't have a rabbi at present, and it's shared around a bit. And I find the wonderful websites for many modern Jewish progressive rabbis, and some Orthodox ones too, very helpful and inspiring on morality and to some extent on economics. In a drash for Miketz, one of the chapters of Genesis, I found Rabbi Jakovsky articulating lessons from Joseph's life that are still important to us around the simultaneous existence of plenty and famine, conspicuous consumption in the First World and starvation in so many countries. And he suggested we needed to learn from Joseph's advice as well as from that of the best thinkers today on the need for careful husbandry, humanity and better distribution of resources, called for action to stave off famine, to avert starvation of the body and the soul, to move us away from apathy. And he said that instead of reconsidering the whole capitalist system, our political leadership wants to use band-aids and bailouts, as we've seen, to resume the whole system. And he suggested we're succumbing to the illusion of endless happiness and success through affluence instead of listening to the message of Joseph's dreams and undertaking internal and personal tikkun olam, good deeds. In another drash for Truma out of Exodus, Rabbi Zeplovitz talked of the list of items for constructing the Mishkan or the tabernacle and likened it to the notion of each person donating according to his or her means, a theme which he says dominates Jewish thought and I think Christian thought too. I mean, individual charity is, of course, common to left and right wing as a desirable thing. But he also talked about fairness, which is important whether you're talking about charitable donations, friend to friends, families, communities, or the tax system. But what constitutes fairness is very much in the eye of the beholder. The current government, which we in New Zealand put into power, I didn't, but some of you possibly did, and certainly New Zealanders did, therefore it is perfectly reasonable that we are getting tax cuts benefiting the highest income groups most, increases in GST, broad, and such like, because that was in the manifesto, at least the broadening tax bases and tax cuts. And it's an important tax principle of horizontal and vertical equity, treating like alike and unalike differently according to their means. But, of course, again, it's very hard to get agreement on operationalise it. But I want to finish by considering one particular area of the minimum wage, sometimes the living wage in the United States, which is a little broader, encompassing Social Security too. It's been one of my interests. We had a $15 an hour minimum wage campaign here before the 2008 election, which was supported by the Greens and Maori parties and the union movement, of course. It's currently $12.75 an hour. Orthodox economics says that raising it loses cost jobs on a wage-employment trade-off, and so it's in the interests of those seeking work not to increase it. Actual evidence on the job losses is very mixed. Proponents, of course, talk about adequacy of income, exploitation, and question, as I already have, the orthodox simple supply and demand account of how wages are fixed in the labour market. In The Case for the Living Wage by Gerald Waltman, he argued, as I do, that poverty and excessive economic inequality are bad for society, and a living wage is one important way of fighting poverty. For this meeting, the most interesting chapter was on religious foundations of a living wage. Waltman shows how from Torah onwards, Jewish traditions place a strong emphasis on caring for the vulnerable, with three bases: emphasis on community, the covenant with God, creating a special place for the oppressed, and seeing poverty as a curse. He included many quotes from Torah, Mishnah, and later, and included Deuteronomy on forgiving debt every 7 years. That's a particular love of mine, that nation. He sees as central compassion, charity, benevolence, and also making the poor independent with the dignity of work, which Chris alluded to, and which does allow for right-wing as well as left-wing agendas. He quoted, I'll leave that one out as I've probably taken too long, but there's a non-partisan coalition in the States that launched an ambitious campaign to increase the minimum wage there, which included very large number of Christian denominations and the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation and some Jewish groups as well. And they said, as people of faith, we believe there is no better way to urgently address the poverty that afflicts so many low-wage working people and their families than by raising the minimum wage. That was Rabbi Heschel, who earlier had marched with Dr. Martin Luther King in Selma. And he said from Deuteronomy, give the laborer their wages in the daytime, and do not let the sun set on them, for they are poor and their life depends on them. I've made it plural because, of course, it was all his originally and not no hers in there. Finally, I like this quote from our prayer book. Pray as if everything depended on God. Act as if everything depended on you. Thanks to Joellen Ducker, our Masphere, who's back there somewhere, who often quotes it. Whatever one's concept of God, the act as if everything depended on you appeal for morality in all behaviour, including economic behaviour, seems a good way of finishing.